This series of inspiring people in medicine and science is supported by a donor who wishes to support us anonymously. And we have donated each sponsor slot to promote awareness of a different organization committed to furthering diversity in medicine. The Doctors Back to School program through the American Medical Association sends minority physicians and minority medical students into schools and underserved communities as a way to introduce children to minority medical role models. There's more information available in the link in the show notes.
We need to start looking at the heterogeneity across lots of different geographic regions, even understanding that there is such enormous heterogeneity between African countries themselves, that there aren't one-size-fits-all tools. There isn't that magic bullet checklists and solutions to implement across the entire global South, right? That's actually not a recipe for success. I am a bit anti-scale, okay? Let me explain what I mean by that. I think that the idea of scale has been perverted away from how I think we need to think of scale in terms of services to human beings. There are some scalable items in the world, like vaccines would be a great example. But not all health issues and not all development-related issues fall into that category.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of people around the world by focusing on their stories. I'm joined today by Amy Lehman, who is founder and CEO at Lake Tanganyika Floating Health Clinic, an international organization whose mission is to address the problem of healthcare access for millions of people who live in the isolated but strategically critical Lake Tanganyika, Great Lakes region of Central Africa. She received both an MD and MBA from the University of Chicago and trained in general surgery at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Additionally, she was a senior fellow with the Clean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics. She received the 2014 Distinguished Young Alumni Award from the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and has been mentioned by Newsweek as one of 150 women who shake the world, as well as by a number of other publications. Welcome, Amy. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Let's start with your background and career journey, because we've a lot to get through here, but I'd love to know where you grew up, what your early interests were, and how you came to decide to pursue medicine as a career.
Well, I grew up in Evanston, which is a suburb of Chicago, and I was a child that was very interested in the natural world. I was interested in medicine. I was interested in lots of things. You know, I can remember being a six-year-old and watching brain surgery on PBS, being absolutely riveted. And, you know, everybody else is like, oh, that's so gross. And I'm like, no, it's so fascinating. So I always was very attracted to that type of material, but I didn't necessarily think that I would go into medicine. And I particularly didn't think I was going to go into medicine after I experienced a fairly significant illness in my childhood. And I was so unhappy with how I felt I was treated by the medical community, how the medical community worked. It felt very cold, non-empathic, non-transparent, without any humility at all. And I thought, oh, God, do I really want to be in that type of field? And for a while, I thought I didn't. But then as I got a bit older and more mature, I felt like it was my responsibility to enter this field and be the type of care provider that I feel patients everywhere deserve to have. And so I decided to do this and entered the medical track a little bit later on in my life.
So interesting. Well, I do understand the brain surgery obsession as a six-year-old, because my father was a doctor too, and I used to obsess over his obstetrics textbooks and the pictures in them. And that was at a very young age too. So I see you, I hear you on that respect. I'd love to know what took you then to the field of international development, because obviously you trained in general surgery. So what opened your eyes to that area.
Some of the health problems that I had experienced when I was younger returned, and I ended up being injured myself by an operation. And so my dominant arm had a sensory nerve injury, and I had to completely retrain my arm and hand. And so when I was in the middle of having this type of experience, I had to face the idea that maybe physically, you know, for these health-related reasons, I might not be able to pursue a lifetime profession of performing surgery. And so if I couldn't do that, what else would I want to do with my life? And I had been to Lake Tanganyika already and was extremely interested in the region. I was extremely interested in some of the history and politics of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I had a very, very close friend of mine who also went to the University of Chicago with me in college and medical school and business school, who is from Tanzania. And as we were studying for our boards, we talked about dreams that we had of being able to go and, you know, partially practice in, you know, East and Central Africa. And so while I was lying in bed recovering from this very serious injury and then thinking about this very long rehab road ahead of me, I thought, well, if I'm not going to be a thoracic surgeon, maybe I want to go and work on Lake Tanganyika. And that's really how I began to seriously entertain the idea that I could do a career 180 and kind of find my footing doing something very different.
Well, I'd love to move now to talk about the Lake Tanganyika Floating Clinic, but I'm going to bring back to the fact that you did an MBA, because what I think is fascinating is to blend that MD-MBA as you did. It's not something you come across every day, those two degrees mixed, because I'd love to hear what kind of a business lens you brought to your vision to develop this floating clinic.
Well, I think that I'm going to mix my answer with this mixed question. And that is to say that when I entered medicine, it was very clear to me that the way that medicine is practiced in the United States, having some fluency and comprehension of the finance and administrative side of US healthcare was absolutely essential if one were to practice in the United States. And originally, I thought that that was going to be my endpoint. I feel that that is a real weakness in the US system, that there isn't a lot of crosstalk between people who are actually doing the medicine and caring for patients and the people who are making business decisions about health systems. That lack of dialogue, I felt, was, you know, very damaging to the health system at large. So it always felt important to me to have that literacy. And then, of course, when I went to start a brand new organization in an extremely difficult part of the world to work in, having these fundamentals about management and financial organization, you know, how to work with teams, how to deal with lots of disparate stakeholders, I felt that my MBA education was very, very crucial to our success.
To mention fragmented supply chains, I'm sure, and other cross-cultural differences, all of which comes up in an MBA.
Yes.
So you tell me about what gave you the idea for starting a clinic there. Can you tell us that again? I think that's a great story.
So I was on Lake Tanganyika on a vacation from my residency, and we took a boat down. This is on the Tanzanian side of Lake Tanganyika. We took a boat down to the southern part of Tanzania, and there was essentially a typhoon that happened. I didn't know that then, but I certainly know it now, that there are certain seasons where the lake is incredibly rough and behaves like an inland sea, can have incredibly high waves, can really be disruptive to infrastructure surrounding the lake. And what in effect happened is the airstrip where we're supposed to have been picked up got washed away. And so we were stranded on Lake Tanganyika and needed to figure out how we were going to get back to an area where we could be picked up and take a plane and get home eventually. So being there and seeing the lack of infrastructure and seeing all of these communities that really did not have the services that all human beings need was extremely thought-provoking for me. And it also made me realize that there are a lot of other ways of thinking about infrastructure, not necessarily tarmacked roads and fixed clinic sites, but also that mobile medicine, thinking about the lake as a highway, as a potential access point, began to sort of go around my head, my thoughts. And from that point, I started to do a lot of research. I started to go back to Lake Tanganyika with a lot of frequency and talk to a lot of different communities and talk to people who worked within the Ministry of Health system and other governmental officials to try and understand what was really going on and how the respective countries serviced their populations.
We're going to talk a lot about your views on international development, because I think that's that is something that challenges some orthodoxy. But another way you challenge orthodoxy is in marketing this clinic. Can you tell us about your back tattoo?
Well, I got the idea for this back tattoo when I was stranded yet again on a beach in Lake Tanganyika. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great to carry around a map of the place? Because, you know, at that time, when people asked me, well, what do you do? Where do you work? And this area was so unknown to so many people. And then there I was, kind of lost on the shores of Lake Tanganyika. I thought, okay, well, maybe what you need is to always have a map of Lake Tanganyika with you. And so when I got back from, you know, that shipwrecking, I decided to forge ahead with this idea.
But it was also an opportunity to have a news magazine article written about you, I think, which is another great marketing ploy.
It's true. It's a great conversation starter, I can say that. And it has appeared in print multiple times. And if people want to look at it, they can Google Amy Lehman tattoo and they can see it for themselves.
Let's move now to talk about international development and some of the problem you were seeking to solve with this solution and the floating clinic. Can you talk to us a little bit about the gaps and flaws that you perceive in the way development aid is delivered today?
I think that despite a lot of conversation to the contrary, aid organizations are incredibly top-down operations. And there is this desire to treat many areas around the world that may be socioeconomically depressed, that may have a very poor public health infrastructure, to see a lot of these areas in a homogeneous way, so that policies that get decided come from places on high, and that they are not nearly informed enough by information from the communities themselves. Who are we trying to serve? And what are the problems that those communities themselves are identifying as their main concerns, things that they would like addressed ideas that they have for improving some of these barriers that affect their everyday lives. And there just really isn't that much of that in reality. There is a lot of lip service to telling people's stories, but the infrastructure of these organizations are not built around that. And I feel like that storytelling is most apparent in fundraising and marketing materials, but is not central to the core organization of how a lot of this aid is delivered. And I think that that is not effective, to be diplomatic. And that we need to start looking at the heterogeneity across lots of different geographic regions, even understanding that there's such enormous heterogeneity between African countries themselves, that there aren't one-size-fits-all tools. There isn't that magic bullet checklists and solutions to implement across the entire global South, right? That's actually not a recipe for success.
How do you balance that with scale, though? Because I'd love to give, maybe can you give an example of, say, some heterogeneity specific to Lake Tanganyika in terms of what they need in particular and what you found works to maybe improve access or really have an impact there? And how do you balance that with, I suppose, these aid organizations' desire to create scale through mass solutions?
I am a bit anti-scale, okay? Let me explain what I mean by that. I think that the idea of scale has been perverted away from how I think we need to think of scale in terms of services to human beings. There are some scalable items in the world, like vaccines would be a great example. But not all health issues and not all development-related issues fall into that category, because there is a profound difference between burden of disease, of certain types of diseases, and operational considerations that make the idea that you're using the same tools in some of these areas, you know, almost absurd. And my greatest example of the failure of scale is with malaria control along Lake Tanganyika and the kind of ubiquitous, you know, malaria bed net that is impregnated with insecticide. So DRC and Nigeria are the two countries that account for the greatest malaria burden globally. And the proportion of mortality is unjustly thrust on probably 18 sub-Saharan African countries. It's not that it's the same across the entire malaria belt. And part of what makes some of these countries with incredibly high mortality rates, what makes it hard to service them, is that alongside the very highest rates of malaria, they also have the very highest rates of all kinds of other diseases, of poverty, maybe of insecurity, maybe of lack of infrastructure. And so thinking about how to successfully improve conditions in those kinds of places requires complex thinking and probably a package of solutions. And what we saw is that probably about 30% of these bed nets that get distributed around Lake Tanganyika, at least 30% of them get diverted and used for fishing in Lake Tanganyika. So this is an extremely complicated issue, and I'm not sure we'll have time to talk about all of that. But if you take fisheries ecology and you take the transmission data that we've been collecting, you know, where do people get bitten? by mosquitoes. Where are they getting malaria? A lot of that transmission is taking place outside. A lot of that transmission is taking place before bedtime. People who live around Lake Tanganyika, in large part, do not have bedrooms and they do not have beds. And so it's actually quite difficult to put up and take down a rectangular bed net that is specifically designed to sit on a bed frame. If you are a person that sleeps on a mat that you roll up every morning and that you use that room for multiple purposes throughout the day. So there are a lot of important qualities to locations as well as activities of communities and needs and pressures that push us to look for alternatives that can do a better job and that don't cause potential harm, like we know that shoreline fishing does with the bed net. So the need to think about tailored solutions should not be a controversial idea, because it's not controversial in the way we think about healthcare delivery in the West and the rich world. We think about very personalized, targeted therapies, and that's appropriate depending on the problem that we are looking at. And so I don't think that it is intellectually consistent to say that we can carve up groups of patients to receive exactly the targeted therapies and interventions that they need for their Western diseases, but that the Black and Brown people in the rest of the world will have to be satisfied with our generic pills and tools and interventions that we give to everybody, regardless of whether or not they happen to be effective in a certain community.
Absolutely fascinating insight, and I'm sure very transferable to many aspects of medicine there. It actually is a good segue into a question around diversity, because a lot of this podcast series focuses on underrepresented voices in medicine and science, whether they be from Black and Brown communities or women in many cases. And what would you say your experience has been of the diversity and inclusion of the medical profession has been? And maybe you can share your insights from working in Africa there too.
I think this is a brighter spot, I will say, in my outlook, in the sense that I think that medicine, at least in the United States, has become more and more diverse. I think we have more different kinds of people from different walks of life. I think we have more women. I think we have more ethnic minorities, and that we're moving in a more positive direction to have, I think, a more representative landscape of caregivers, at least in this country. In some of the places where I've worked, I think there's some kind of contradictory data, if you will. On one hand, I think there are some pretty entrenched misogynistic ideas about the role of women and who should hold power and who should not hold power. But at the same time, in communities on the ground, there are a lot of women that are very, very, very participatory at working as community health workers who are important advocates for their communities, et cetera. And so, you know, for me, I think I would take a couple of steps back and look at the structure, some of the problems. And for me, it's sort of about who is holding power and how is that power being wielded. These power dynamics are really important in medicine because, on one hand, it's really important that people who have the training and the expertise and the know-how, they should be empowered to care for people and make decisions sometimes and help their patients make decisions based on scientific facts and reality. But at the same time, it's very easy to veer off from that delineated area of expertise and to feel like you can wield power over people who are vulnerable. And many patients who are in the health system are vulnerable people. And if they are patients that also come from underrepresented communities who have had very poor experiences in the past with organized health throughout history, to have a variety of providers who can empathize with those experiences and who can connect and build trust to every variety of patient, that's incredibly important, I believe, in that healthcare relationship.
It's interesting because I've always had the concept that knowledge is power. And I'd love to know what you think of the idea that in healthcare in general, in medicine, power is not a zero-sum game. So people can take power through advocacy, through self-advocacy, and that can sometimes be shown to them through role modeling, through example. Do you think that that's sort of some sign of how things could go if people increasingly take more control over their own healthcare where possible?
I think that education of the patient is incredibly important. That's always been incredibly important to me. But I also want to say that education does not equal Googling. And there are also some things, right, that people believe and that they want that are not supported by science as well. Like some of the alternative therapies for COVID, for example, where if you look at the data and how studies were performed, it's very clear that these alternatives weren't doing what people were asserting they were doing. And so that is very important. I feel that there is a difference between knowledge and dignity and respect. I never expected any patient coming in, you know, way back when I was training and I was working with my mentor, who's a thoracic surgeon, seeing patients coming into the office with a lung cancer or an esophageal cancer. I never expected them to have the knowledge. I wanted to help them acquire that knowledge. I wanted to participate in their education, but I always felt that they had autonomy and all of my respect, right, as another human being who ultimately has to decide what treatment path do I want to pursue and what do I need to know about the options of pursuing my treatment so that I can choose something that is best for me as an autonomous individual. That, I think, is what is the most important part about that trust between a practitioner and a patient.
Well, here. Well, we could do a whole separate podcast on COVID and misbeliefs and Africa and otherwise, but let's leave that for a separate recording. And I'd just like to return to some personal reflections. So I don't think you build a career in a place as potentially as volatile and clearly as susceptible to weather conditions as Central Africa without having some ups and downs. Were there any high points and low points that stand out to you of your career so far?
We face a lot of really difficult challenges all the time that can come in the form of insecurity, physical insecurity, that has been a constant threat to us during the past number of years. There's been a lot of instability in the African Great Lakes over the past few years. There's a state of very high tension right now. And that's always a risk. And it's really crushing if we've been working to plan outreach work for months, and then we have to delay, and we're not sure how long we have to delay because there is physical insecurity on the ground, and we really just can't get where we need to be in order to do our work. That happens with some frequency. And so we've learned over the years and with very careful planning and prognostication with our deep relationships that we've developed with communities to work around those types of interruptions. I will say that it can be extremely demoralizing to see how the world can only maintain attention on certain a certain number of bad things in a certain number of places at one time, and to feel constantly displaced away from the global stage about things that are really crucial and important that matter also to the wider world when some other problem happens in another part of the world. And I am with Ukraine. I think what is going on is absolutely terrible, but I also feel that it is hard to have all of this attention focused on one part of the world that happens often at the expense of other parts of the world. And those problems haven't gone away in other parts of the world. And so striving to find some way to balance this is, you know, an ongoing challenge. But I will say that just doing the work is unbelievably rewarding in and of itself. I mean, I've been in the field with my staff in very, very challenging conditions. And after a great day, let's say, of household surveying and interviewing, where we obtained like really deep insight, you know, we felt like, oh, okay, we're really understanding some of the puzzle pieces here. You know, we come back covered in a layer of dust, you know, with nowhere to wash, by the way. And we feel really exhilarated because it's so tangible. It feels really tangible to be in such close collaboration with these communities that we're trying to serve and to feel like we're really learning and connecting and understanding deep things, and that we are then in the position to help interpret that, to broadcast that knowledge, hopefully to some of these larger organizations with deep pocketbooks who hopefully will, you know, begin to address some of the issues that we raise. And the work itself is just so stimulating and rewarding. So we all love doing it, despite the fact that it's so hard.
Well, you certainly convey, I think, very vividly how intoxicating it can be to really gain that knowledge. And getting back to my knowledge is power quip, that does give you power when you gain that knowledge over a community. My last question is around any creed or motto that you live by, or any maybe words of wisdom that you've gleaned from this fascinating career that spans so many geographies.
Well, I say it as a joke, but I also kind of mean it, that my mantra in life is, I don't know. But I mean that in the most open-minded way possible, which is, hey, I'm not going to go into a situation with preconceived ideas. I'm not going to think I know what's going on. I'm going to be as open-minded as possible. I'm going to go in and I'm going to learn, and that I'm not going to project. And so even though it's a joke, it's also true to say, I don't know, which another way of saying that would be, is to always have humility. No matter how successful a person can be in their field, in their business or whatever, that doesn't mean that you are also an expert across all these other domains, right? It's always reminding oneself that you have to have the humility to recognize that sometimes you go from being an expert or a master of the universe, right? In your business domain, and then you go into a totally different context and you have to reposition yourself again as a learner, as an open-minded, humble person. I think that's been the most important lesson of my work in this part of the world and in the whole world, frankly.
Well, Amy, it's been such a revelation to hear from someone who's quite literally made a mark in Central Africa, in an area perhaps where no woman has gone before in terms of the medical practice you've built, and yet still have such humility. And that is, I think, a refreshing reminder to all of us that even in something as vast and sometimes intractable, maybe, as international development, the devil is in the detail, and really the answers are in the nuance. So thank you for reminding us of that and for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring people and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.